Hello. Thank you for listening to this episode. Do you think of yourself as left on the political spectra, right, or perhaps a little centre? This dichotomic division of political opinions into simplified, generalised categories has been a relatively recent innovation, only about 100 years old in the terms we understand it today. Generalisations are useful for people to understand complicated concepts, but they also tend to be the place that people turn to when they don't understand something nor have the desire to try to. This dichotomy causes people to view their political affiliations in ways similar to how people understand their sporting team affiliations. It becomes an emotional exercise in loyalty to one and vitriol to another. Unlike a sporting game with specific rules of engagement, politics is meant to be an open arena, the art of finding how people can get along. It is not meant to be viewed in terms of a dichotomy where people can ally themselves to a side. Whenever people ally themselves to a political party, you can just about guarantee that their critical eye will be dulled as they readily accept the rhetoric of their chosen team. I can understand that it might seem like a lot of work to constantly remain vigilant and critical, but it doesn't have to be. Right now, our political discussions are full of useless rhetoric. It is sometimes hard to sift through all the marketing-esque language that drives the politics, and easy to get caught up in what amounts to nonsense talk, the kind of thing you'd expect from seedy snake oil merchants. But before you express your distaste at a policy or your desire for another, think about it. Think hard. Do you understand the terms you're about to use? Or are you about to act like a politically branded photocopier with thumbs? Don't think of yourself as a dumb person whose opinion doesn't matter. But don't get caught up in emotional arguments filled with rhetoric and barely understandable terms. Engage in political discussions, because your voice matters. But try and think through what you're arguing and understand it from your own perspective. If it is too abstract, then you might be unwittingly reflecting another's opinion. When Orwell spoke of doublespeak, this is the sort of thing he was referring to. The manipulation of language so that you will regurgitate it when triggered without understanding what it means. The hijacking of language in order to fulfill a hidden agenda. You are important. You are a culmination of all that has come before you, and you are part of an interconnected group of creatures living right now. There is a thought that everyone has an agenda, and perhaps this is true, but I tend to believe that our individual agendas are just fragments of a larger agenda that pulses through humanity. Through discussion and collaboration, we can put the pieces together and start to see the bigger picture. But through fighting and division, we reduce our cooperative ability and view the world from a sporting team mentality. The world is not black and white. It is vivid. Our brains could only process so much information, so don't try and overload it. Sometimes you might necessarily resort back to black and white generalizations, but don't forget that that's all they are, and they should be malleable, considering the potential of interactions with others in the future. There is no left wing or right wing. There are a myriad of thoughts and opinions. Discuss your thoughts and opinions and be prepared to change them. We are ever-shifting beings, never the same moment to moment, but always connected to each moment and each other. Welcome to In Psychedelia, our collaboration of voices, opinions, and thought. I am always looking for any kind of contribution. Music, poetry, rants, discussions, debate, experiences, monologues, skits, or whatever. If you've got something you'd like to contribute, contact me by heading to the Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/InPsychedelia, or through the Podomatic page. I often go along to festivals and hear performers I love, and almost immediately forget their names. It feels a little disappointing later, because I want to go and find that artist again, and see them live again. But some performers stick out even more than others. I remember being at Renaissance Festival a few years back, and seeing a rapper named Hugo perform with dubbed the Magic Dragon. Never have I experienced any performance like that. The whole thing felt like an orchestration, not just of the music, but of the crowd as well. Hugo ensured that we were as much a part of the experience as his rap and the musician's tunes. I've made sure to see Hugo whenever I can, and he doesn't disappoint. Later I discovered that he is part of a duo that write and perform an alternative take on current events. Juice Media's Rap News is the collaborative conjunction of the minds of Giordano Nanni and Hugo Ferrand, and their latest exploration came out this week, pointing its eye toward the increasing legislation and control sought over the internet by governments. Head to the Podomatic page to see the video for the song and to get a download link. But most importantly, remember that it takes a lot of time and effort for people to make their works. So if you enjoy what these two do and have a spare few dollars, head to thejuicemedia.com/donate. Giordano Nanni and Hugo Ferrand with the latest installment of Rap News.
Welcome back, netizens, to this newest edition in Juice Media series of Rap News Journalism with me, Robert Foster. This evening, we're actively delving in depth to facts which affect all of us who dwell on this internet. And we've got to give a special welcome to all the ladies and agents from the NSA, ACO, MI5. Glad you're listening in, because today's show is all about surveillance and how it's spreading from the streets into our modems. As we speak, laws are being tacitly written in to implement ways of controlling the expanse of this internet. To keep us safe, we're told. But from whom? And will this place ever be the same if these plans go through? To find out, we connect with our first guest to comment on the matter. We're live at the Panopticon with General Baxter. General?
Son?
Good to have you back again with us. Explain why the state is spying on us.
My fellow Oceanians, as you know, we've always been at war with Eurasia.
Or is it East Asia?
Either way, it's war and we need division to wage it. But now the proles are connecting online, bypassing these illusory divisions of race, religion, and nationality.
Sounds grand to me.
It's a catastrophe. Centuries of hard work are being undone, profits are vanishing, and it's due to the internet. It's empowering humanity. We need to get this snafu under control rapidly.
How?
Behold the latest weapon in the war of terror. Our greatest invention since 9/11. Guaranteed to keep us free and safe forever. I give you the surveillance state, ladies and generals. Our secret wires log your key style. Monitor every single number on your speed dial. Rewind straight to your position with facial recognition and pinpoint you within 0.03 of a mile. We've put eyes everywhere without consulting you, keeping you safe whether or not you want us to. Soon there'll be no freedoms left for threatening. Then we'll have won the war. Take that, terrorism.
Brilliant. Thank you, General. We now interview our resident guru, Terrence Moonseed, for a different view.
Greetings.
How does this situation look?
I have one word for you, Robert. Double plus ungood. The world populace of 7.4 billion are all headed in the direction of Orwellian totalitarian oblivion. My voice is hoarse, yelling about stellar winds, cold chilling them and trap wire weaving through the world wide web we all dwelling in. Face it, the all-seeing eyes in all of our Facebooks like a virus, and in these iPhones with Siri, or should I say Iris. Next in line is RFID devices and mind shifts triggered by chemtrails the plague spray the sky with. This time it's too far. Check out the base they're building in Utah, where they'll be storing all your data for over a century. It's FUBAR. And under the outback is an entire tunnel of wires, an echelon base called Pine Gap to hijack our mother Gaia.
Hey, maybe your mother's gayer.
Boo-hoo. Why didn't you just kill yourself like most of your troops do?
That's it. Now you're on the cast iron list.
Hang on, General. Why weren't we informed about this?
Sorry we didn't tell you about our grand plan before. It was meant to be a surprise, under wraps in a store. But some spoil sports had to go and ruin it for all by blowing whistles in spite of the damn law.
Bill, Benny, and Thomas Drake are trailblazers for leaking these tactics.
Hey, civil liberty factivists, activists, this is all legal. Anything we do now actually is.
How did...
You can't question my authority, thanks to this.
And that shit's global, people. In Australia, it's now legal for the government to store all SMSs, searches, and emails. Australians, it's taking place under your nose. Unless you wake up, all your data are belong to ASIO.
Come on, everyone knows. You can trust the government now. If you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to worry about.
That might be the case with things that are happening now, because most people agree with most of the laws that are being handed down. But once the Illuminati reveal their agenda for you, this surveillance will enforce laws you no longer consent to. But by then it'll be too late to protest too. And anything you've ever said, typed, or browsed can or will be used against you.
I'm confused. So what should we do then?
What should we do?
Nothing.
This is all an illusion. It's just a riot, a delusion, the Matrix, the Maya deceiving us.
Oh, you hippies really make our job so much easier.
Sorry to interrupt, but we're picking up a signal from beyond the space-time continuum. Quick, switch on the juice channeling portal. Wait, is that
George Orwell?
Good day to you.
Wow, what do we owe this honor to?
I tried to warn you noobs, but I see you are actually fools, or else you thought this was an instruction manual.
Yes, so can you advise us? What would you have us do?
An open and universal internet is the most effective tool you have to address the issues that afflict the world at hand. Therefore, protecting it is the most essential task that stands before your generation.
I think I understand.
Hush, man, you must not lose the internet. Heed this mantra. Who controls the internet controls the data. And who controls the data controls the future.
We're losing you.
I leave you with a tool to use.
An onion?
Don't be simple, Robert. This is but a simile. It stands for Tor.
Tor?
Google it. It's for anonymity. This onion router open network helps considerably against tyranny, but its abilities only work if all you f***ers use it consistently. And even if you don't use it, run it, so it's forced. Well,
thanks, Mr. Orwell.
From no one call me George Torwell. If we'd had such tools when I wrote this, well, it would have been so much simpler to tell Big Brother to go f*** himself. The mother sucking piece of sh.
Thanks, George Torwell, for manifesting direct from this memory hole of history to impress on us these messages. We're told we need safety, which is precious, yes, but can a society that can enforce all its laws ever progress? Hindsight shows that many figures guilty of thought crime turned out to be luminaries and heroes before their time. But if a surveillance state had reigned then in this form and design, just think of all the progress we may have all been denied. Could lobbies for women's or gay rights have appeared and thrived? Would revolutionary ideals have materialized? Would science have pioneered or even survived if every word had been monitored by thought? What, police and spies? Big Brother brings chilling effects, freezing our collective hopes. He doesn't protect our safety, but protects the status quo and threatens this internet, the one channel yet uncontrolled, whose openness we are now called upon to effect and uphold.
Started warming up our collective encoldened souls and brought the flowers and critters out once more. And with the coming of spring and warmer weather means the coming of festival season. This year, Belgrave, the gateway to the Dandenong Ranges and end of the train line, will play host to a new festival, aiming to bring out artists of all persuasions for a day of sharing and festivities. Brent Dacus, co-owner of Belgrave store Limerence, is part of the committee heading up Belgrave's festival, called End of the Line. Brent, welcome to In Psychedelia.
Thank you very much.
So can you tell us a little bit about the idea behind the festival?
Yeah, look, I mean, the idea was that, we've been in our shop now for just over 2 years, and we meet so many artists out here, and it seems that every single day we meet someone else that's coming out from town. And there's just so much creativity out here, and there's not a whole lot going on in Belgrave. You know, there's festivals that happen in neighbouring suburbs, and that's all well and true. That's fine. But we just thought, hey, why not do something here that's really cool? And it doesn't have to be another, you know, NAF craft festival. It could be something totally awesome. And so we just decided to do something and held a bit of a community meeting and gauged interest. And of course, I think we had 30-something people rock up to this meeting at a little bar down the street and pack the place out. And so we started it up, and we've got a really good little crew now of 5 or 6 committee members that are pumping it out and utilising social media and all sorts of stuff, or, you know, exciting new ideas for marketing.
Fantastic.
And, yeah.
So where are you at with preparations for the festival?
Well, at the moment, we've got our name, we've got End of the Line, we've got a website, we've got a Facebook page, and we're taking bookings now. We're basically, it's gonna have sort of a few parts. We're gonna have heaps of market stalls, but it's not just going to be people selling wares. We want artists, we want performers, we want all that sort of stuff. So we're taking bookings on that, and we've got. I don't know how many people know of the Cameo Cinema, but we're being given the outdoor cinema at Cameo to use as a stage.
Fantastic.
We're gonna have some internal cinemas too, and a couple of other fringe stages. So we're just booking acts and basically getting as many people involved as we can. Because it's all community funded, so we're just trying to do what we can to make the first one as awesome as we absolutely can, so that it can continue for years to come. So that's where at the moment, yeah.
For those who know the layout of Belgrave, you've kind of got one end of town
it's got a big hill and there's sort of a park area. The other end of town is where the cinema is. What's the kind of layout of the festival going to be like?
Well, our thoughts at the moment are that we're really, considering we've caught it end of the line, we want to take hold of public transport and get people to be public transporting it here. So we're thinking that we'll actually funnel people through a bit of a marketplace from the station, and then basically the majority of the festival will actually happen in the car park next to the Cameo.
Yep.
So we'll have like the bottom levels, we'll have a bit of a secluded secret pathway to the back of the Cameo. We're going to speak to the guys at Earth of Pleasures, which, as people that come to Belgrade know, is the most awesome place to go for a scenic coffee. So it'll all be up that kind of end of town is the current plan. So
how can people get involved if somebody's sitting at home right now or in their car or a train or whatever and they're thinking, hey, I'm kind of vaguely talented and I'd like to go and express my talent?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, at the moment, the easiest thing to do is we've got the website, which is just endofthelinefestival.com. That's got a link to the Facebook page as well, which is where we'll do most of our updating.
And we'll put a link up on the In Psychedelia podcast page for anybody that missed that.
Absolutely. Yeah, and there's an apply here button on that page too if people want to, do roving performances. We want to get circusy stuff. We want to organise a burlesque night for the night. We're going to have poetry readings in some downstairs bars and stuff, so it should be a lot of fun.
Are there any sort of prerequisites or conditions for people's involvement with the festival?
We haven't really thought about that, so I guess that's not yet.
I suppose if you're under 18, get your parents' permission or something.
Yeah, I guess so. We don't even know that much yet. So
let's just go through a quick rundown. What's the date that the festival is on?
It's November 24th this year, and it's just going to be for the one day, the Saturday, and next year we're wanting to make it a week-long festival.
So, wow. So are you planning to have it an all-day-long festival into the night as well?
Yes, it will be.
Fantastic. And it's going to be in Belgrave, which is the end of the Belgrave train line. The website again?
Is www.endofthelinefestival.com.
And if anybody wants to speak to you personally, then they can drop into Limerence in Belgrave.
Absolutely can, or they can shoot an email to us too.
What's your email address?
Look, the best one for the festival stuff is info@endofthelinefestival.com.
There you go. Thank you very much, Brent. And
thanks, Nick.
Look forward to the festival.
Indeed.
One local producer who said he'll be performing at the festival is Bradija. This is the Forest of Shaolin Frowns.
Thank you. This is a film review of Eugene Jarecki's The House I Live In. To the many fans of The Wire, you would be forgiven for thinking that it is not essential you see any other exposé detailing America's war on drugs. And potentially you don't, if you've recently watched The Wire or have a first viewing to anticipate. That five-season television tour de force examination of one of America's most corrupted drug cities, Baltimore, was as thorough an indictment of the perceived war as you're likely to see. But for myself, who has been trying unsuccessfully with my time constraints to re-watch the television series that even Wikipedia claims is considered one of the greatest series ever, I thought I'd catch The House I Live In at the latest Melbourne International Film Festival purely on the basis that the synopsis referred to it as a condensed version of The Wire. And perhaps if I had done a bit more research on the film that I was walking into, I wouldn't have been plagued with the incessant desire to creep out again in the first 15 minutes or so. The footage before me was making me squirm. It showed the director's childhood nanny as if she were a leading authority on why drugs are bad. It boasted footage showing buff, tanned, and probably roided Miami police officers throwing black teens up against the wall of liquor stores, like an episode of Cops. It had countless parents crying in the wake of their children's overdose or incarceration. Yes, I'm aware drugs are dangerous, but I'm more averse to a preachy film showing me we aren't doing enough to lock up these filthy users and baby killers. It looked like it was everything I was loath to see in a documentary. Subjective, biased, and personal for writer-director Eugene Jarecki. But Jarecki has a lot more credentials than I gave him credit for, and by the film's end, he'd done a 1-2 knockout on me and my expectations. In fact, I'm surprised that Jarecki isn't high on America's anti-patriot list, alongside fellow documentary maker Michael Moore. In 2006, his award-winning documentary While We Fight asserted that the US deliberately and deceitfully engaged in wars to sustain and drive their military-industrial economy, while in 2010 he did a piece for the Freakonomics documentary which suggested that the legalization of abortion in 1973 was essential for the decline in urban crime rate in the 90s. In his latest film, he provides strong and damnable evidence that not only shows that the US war on drugs has been a failure, but that the incarceration of millions of its citizens is Holocaustian in proportion. So if the film seems over-emotive at the beginning, it's only because Jarecki clearly finds the situation so overwhelmingly distressing. Like The Wire, he wants to encapsulate the full spectrum of players, which sees him visiting police task force, street dealers, judges, prisoners and prison guards, amongst others. He treats each subject with an even-handed respect, and Jarecki's compassion for humanity is evident in the way he interviews both families corrupted by the influence of drugs and dealers who supplied it to them, with equality. Like The Wire, there is no clear line between good and evil, and even many of the judges here acknowledge that the drug laws that see them put away young users for many years are arbitrary means of dealing with a real social epidemic. Jarecki's contention that the US is largely guilty of carrying on a war that has failed on almost every level is backed up with statistics and talking heads that seem legitimate but could use some closer inspection. But the implications he delivers are clear. No other country is jailing their own citizens on the scale the US is, and their persistent jailing is propagating a cycle where they must build new prisons to house their inmates and find new inmates to finance the expensive industrialization they've developed. It's the always impressive David Simon who steals the show every time he graces the screen. The thoughtful guru on the topic, who has spent years researching the situation and frequenting street corners as much as he does police stations, always comes across as the voice of reason, so his contributions to the film make it more trustworthy in its claims. The approach doesn't make this one of the better made documentaries I've seen, and I felt that it would have been more effective had Jarecki removed himself from the action a little more. But having said that, his passion is evident, and his humanity helps to make the film moving while stimulating thought. I can't think of a better non-fiction attack on the war on drugs than Jarecki's The House I Live In. I think it contains a strong advocacy for change that would sway hardened loyalists to the war. It's just a matter of making sure it reaches the appropriate audience. It won an esteemed prize for documentary filmmaking at a recent Sundance Festival, which will help it reach a wider audience. But as the title suggests for Americans, this is not an issue only affecting their impoverished neighbors. The idea of the United States of America suggests solidarity, which for Jarecki means advocating change and having humanity for those whose lives have been destroyed as much by the prohibition of drugs than as the drugs themselves. For Australia, we need to contemplate whether this model we closely abide by is the most effective way of dealing with a societal issue.
Thanks to Randall for that movie review of Eugene Jarecki's The House I Live In. Further details can be found on the Facebook group and at encyclopedia.podomatic.com. This is an a cappella piece from Justine Walsh, Soul Thread.
Isn't it strange how it transforms moment to moment from where you were to where you are and now where you are and now and do you ever see your face through my eyes? Or remember my dreams? Or feel the edge of my skin and hair where it meets the air? Why? Observational exploration. Solitary creatures with potential for the foresight of a hive mind, with the right kind of tools, without denial or fear. I crafted for everything between my skin and the edge of well. How could one feel so much compassion for infinity? Curiosity, speak to me, ask me, ask, and receive far more than you bargained for in the guise of less. Perspective's relevance dissolves. When not seen or heard or known or learned but is. When in all moments this moment is rising, always perceive the glowing of each soul thread weaving itself out of, into this same multidimensional ball of wool. Light moves in waves and forms reactions that are waves, sent and formed into thought that are waves, that inform other waves, and so we flow and ebb and flow. I love to know of more questions, and I love to be more questions, and I love you, and so we do.
Who are drug users? The word user seems to conjure images of aggressive, dirty, jobless people, addicts to their chosen evil drug. But how close is this to the truth? You could probably answer this yourself. You probably know or have known some people who indulge in alternative inebriants. Most people have probably come across somebody among their peers that indulges in some illicit drug. So why does this image of a user still seem to exist? Is it a matter of cognitive dissonance in public discourse? The National Drug Research Institute at Curtin University is participating in an international research project which looks at why people grow cannabis and who's growing it. Dr. Monica Barrett is a research fellow with the institute conducting the study. Monica, welcome to In Psychedelia.
Thanks for having me on the show, Nick.
So can you tell us a little bit about what this piece of research hopes to illuminate?
Look, what we're doing here is trying to better understand small-scale cannabis growing, so folks that are growing in their own backyards or maybe in their cupboard or something of that nature, and seeing how these patterns of growing differ across different countries across the world. So there's ourselves here in Australia, as well as US, Canada, UK, a few different European countries, including Belgium, the Netherlands, Finland, and Denmark. And of course, people from other parts of the world that aren't covered. We're going to have an international rest of world survey, I guess you could say, to cover as many people as we can.
Is there, to your knowledge, is there any kind of research like this that has happened before?
Look, it appears to be the first of its kind in that we're trying to do something that's comparable globally. And look, you know, we're not even going to achieve that. We're just doing the best we can in terms of worldwide, because obviously there's going to be a lot of different countries and different languages that we don't cover. And our group is, you know, necessarily unable to cover all countries. But there isn't really any research that does this. What we know about cannabis growing in terms of the research tends to be from criminal investigations, maybe from people who've been caught by the police. And as you can well be aware, that doesn't really cover the majority of people who are doing this, you know, without really coming to the attention of any authorities.
So what are you hoping to... Once you've finished this research, what are you hoping will come out of it?
Well, one of the things that we'd like to do is really sort of break down some of the stereotypes that, you know, as you mentioned in your introduction there, what people in sort of general populations tend to think about. What is the drug user? Who is this person, the drug user? Who is the cannabis grower? And people often have a very stereotyped view of that. And so we felt, you know, it'd be good to just be able to do a really simple thing and ask people who grow cannabis, well, you know, how old are you and what's your gender and what's your family situation and where do you live and, you know, what's your main income source, that kind of thing. And then you can build a picture. And the picture that you tend to get and what we expect to find is of the normal person. You know, people who grow cannabis are not that different from everybody else. And that's just one small example, which I guess you can broaden out to think about all different kinds of drug users who are really just ordinary people who happen to be, as you say, using an inebriate that perhaps isn't alcohol, that is cannabis or many of the other varieties that are out there of drugs.
Now, you've been researching the drug-taking community for over 10 years now. Have you seen a shift in public discourse on the topic in that time?
It's a good question. I think for me, you know, I'm 33 now and I was 22 when I first started as a research assistant for the National Drug Research Institute, and I've worked in a number of other places too. So I guess in some ways, you know, my sense of the world has changed in terms of, you know, I wonder whether the changes that I see reflect just my growth in 10 years of my life. But I think, you know, in the last 12 months, you would have noticed a greater debate, with the Australia 21 report and that kind of thing coming out in Australia. And then also I had the experience of being able to go to Canterbury, UK, just in May, for an international conference on drug policy. And in an international sense, there seemed to be a lot of movement, you know, lots of different countries really looking quite critically at their drug laws. But as to whether that's really taken hold here in Australia, you know, I think we're in a difficult political time. You know, we've got a government that, you know, sort of walking on a tightrope in terms of their political life. So it's tricky to get these kinds of issues, you know, sort of talked about. But there's definitely some movement across the world, I think, in just looking critically. And I'm not saying here that this means we should, you know, legalise all drugs, but I think it means that there are certainly a lot of countries that are thinking, actually critically looking at how we should regulate drugs, and that's a really good step forward.
I think the Bolivian president this week, or prime minister, I can't remember if it's a president, he came out this week and said that they want to take a serious look at their drug policy and start to change things. But you're right, in Australia we seem to have a bit of a stunted public conversation about it. politicians, it's a very murky topic for them to touch. Have you ever been contacted by politicians wanting to know more about your work and what you do? Because presumably the Institute is all about feeding things to politicians to make new policy. So have you ever heard from politicians wanting to know more?
Well, on a personal level, I haven't directly engaged with politicians. What I've done directly and through the Institute is we've had some meetings with some bureaucrats from Canberra who are part of the Department of Health and Ageing, and they ultimately fund us as an institute. So there's a strong relationship between the Department of Health and Ageing and the Commonwealth in Canberra and our institute. And what's been interesting for me is just coming in as a junior researcher and being able to feed into those discussions. And my small amount of experience with that so far is that the bureaucrats that I've spoken to seem to be really well aware of these issues. That they're certainly not ignorant of the issues, and that they seem really willing to listen. So that was great, because I hadn't really met many Canberra bureaucrats before, so I guess perhaps I had a stereotype view of what they did and what they thought. But I was surprised by how open they were in person to different ideas and different policies. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean that those ideas get through to the higher echelons of politics. But, you know, my small experience thus far gives me some, I guess, hope that there are some people there that are interested in change.
It's funny, because your comments on that, I've heard that from a lot of other people. A lot of people seem to speak to politicians and bureaucrats and people working in public policy, and what they say behind closed doors or in personal conversations and what happens in the public discourse are two very different things.
That's right. And I think that tells you a lot about the effect of the system. You know, there may be many individuals, and perhaps the majority of individuals in the system, that might want a particular change, but that doesn't necessarily mean a change could happen. People at the top have a vested interest in particular, you know, status quo remaining. So, you know, it's, you know, and I don't think that means we should just sort of throw our hands up in the air. And for me, obviously, you know, I've got a career here in a situation where, you know, I do question, is it worth me doing this? Because will it ever affect change? And in my mind, I think, well, you know, I can only try. That's where I come to. And if I can, through this research with the cannabis growers or many of the other projects that we're doing, if I can at least put into the public sphere on numerous occasions images that might break stereotypes of people in the community, then that's going to have some effect. Because ultimately, you know, we would hope that through the voting power of the public, there could be some change. And I know it's more complicated than that, because we're involved in international treaties and, you know, we have international relationships that as a country we need to maintain. And, you know, that is an issue that we have to think about. How much of this is bound up in, say, our relationship with America? And you know, is it really about our best interests as a nation, our drugs policy, or is it about other countries?
Yeah, well, that's certainly a difficult question, because then it turns into a global scale. And I know the United Nations has a position on drugs, and that's probably the main international convention that would be difficult to overcome for any single state.
Yes. Professor Robin Room, he also is from Turning Point Alcohol and Drug Centre, which is sort of where I'm located. It's the National Drug Research Institute's head office is in Perth, but I'm here in Melbourne. And he's done some work on these UN treaties and looked at whether it's possible for a country to, I can't remember the exact words, that they remove themselves from the treaties and then they come back into the treaty with a reservation. And they say, look, we still want to be part of this treaty, but we just removed one part. So say you wanted to legalise cannabis but not all the other drugs, you could potentially come back into the treaty. So there are actually lots of different options that are possible legally. As to whether they would be possible diplomatically is the question.
Do you think there's anything that the drug-taking community, the people that are actually in the direct firing line of these policies, can do to help change this? Is there anything that, in your opinion, you think that people can do?
Yeah, look, it's a tricky question that I have been pondering for a long time, and I think it's really difficult because on the one hand, you can sort of sacrifice yourself, get out there and say, hey, guys, you know, I'm going to hand myself into the police, put me on today, tonight, I'm a drug user and, you know, this is ridiculous. These sort of ideas come up. But I have wondered, you know, given that there are millions and millions of people in Australia who have at least tried an illicit substance, and there are only 22 million of us, you know, what if we all sort of at the same time, you know, what if every single person, I don't know, 6 million people kind of said, you know what, arrest me.
Yeah, if everybody came out of the closet at once, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think that analogy to, you know, the coming out of the closet idea, it's been flying around in my mind. One of the reasons for that is, as I've been thinking about how we might use the internet to assist with that. You know, what if we were all able to organise ourselves sort of in a group anonymously before coming out? Sort of all organise yourself and then say, right, I don't know, 1st of January 2013, we're all going to stand up at once. And how are the police going to arrest everyone? You know, something of that nature. And unfortunately, it's difficult because I don't think we have the solidarity.
No.
I don't think every single person that's ever used an illicit substance in their lifetime is going to have that solidarity or that... you know, it's going to take that risk. So it's difficult when you've got, on the one hand, you know, if we didn't have the problem of some people who have used drugs even demonising other people who have used drugs.
Yeah,
you know, so the folks that are on methadone or are taking heroin every day, you know, there will be the other drug user will say, look, you know, they're a problem, those people over there. And so there's the us and them, not only between the people who don't use drugs and those who do, but also within the people who use drugs and which drugs are they using and how hard are they going. And
yeah.
So it's hard for us all to come together. I think if we could all come together. And also, there's people who have never, and these are actually the most amazing examples, people who have never even tried any illicit drug that come forward and actually say they want change in the drug laws.
Yeah, well, that's probably a good sign for those who do take drugs, that it's not just about involving yourself in the illicit side of things. People can actually rationally think about something and see the evidence and say, well, hang on a minute, I don't want to do that myself, but this seems a bit silly.
Yeah, so I've definitely read some I have to get the information for you. I've read some really convincing arguments written by people who at the start say, look, I'm a young person, never touched cannabis, never touched any drugs, but I've read about this issue and it just seems ridiculous to me that there are people dying and that, you know, we don't have full information and that people that want to use drugs don't, you know, have pure drugs available to them and are dying due to this. And they come out and say, look, it's not, you know, you can't say that I'm doing this for my own benefit because I don't use them. I'm never going to. But this seems to me to be the most logical way to deal with this. Those people, I think, coming back to your question, those people are important to get on side as well.
Absolutely.
Having those people.
And I think there is a changing tide, but maybe that's just my feeling. I mean, as you said before, sometimes it's hard to tell whether it's just you're getting more involved and you see more, or if things actually are maybe slightly changing. But I think there is one way that people, if they're listening right now, can help to change things, and that's there's anyone listening who has grown cannabis in the past and is over the age of 18. How can they get involved with your study, Monica?
Well, all they need to do is look at our website, which is worldwideweed.nl. So worldwideweed.nl, and that's the international studies website. And then you'll see a little link there for Australia. And indeed, if you're an international listener, you can click on the other links for the different countries. And you can read all about who we are and our publications and get a better sense of the project too.
And I'll put a link up for that on the psychedelia.podomatic.com page as well, so that if you miss that, you can just click the link there. Thanks very much for chatting to me, Monica.
Thanks heaps, Nick.
Thank you to contributors to this episode of In Psychedelia. Further details on the artists, festivals, movies, and research discussed in this week's episode can be found by visiting psychedelia.podomatic.com or the Facebook group. Just as I am about to finish this episode, Dr. Monica Barrett posted a link to a new report from the Australia 21 group. This new report suggests policy alternatives to the current war on drugs, intended to minimise all harms associated with currently illicit substances. I have posted a link to the ABC News report, which includes a direct link to the Australia 21 report for you to read. Keep the discussion flowing. If you have read, seen, or heard something interesting, post it to the Facebook group. Or, even better, write and record a piece for the podcast. And, as always, if you have anything at all to contribute, contact me via the Facebook group or Podomatic page. In Psychedelia is our collaborative project.